Coming up today, your vacuum cleaner wants to know everything about your living room, Vicky Turk explores the new Valerian film, and we dive into the latest startup fundraising trend. You're listening to episode 328 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, Matt Burgess. James Templeton's on holiday this week, but joining me are Roland Manthorpe.
Hello.
And Vicky Turk.
Hi.
Roland, straight in. What have you learned this week?
So I learned that in the last 3 years, no, hang on, that, what was it again?
You really paid a lot of attention to what you were learning.
Well, yeah, you can tell that I learned it. Well, someone told me this at an event, and basically, China has used 3 times more concrete in the last number of years that I can't remember, recent, than the US used in the entire 20th century.
Well, that's presumably a lot of concrete if you knew how much it was or when it was or anything else about this.
Oh, details. I don't know any of that.
So is this for, like, building things?
Yes. It's basically a kind of fact about the amazing growth of infrastructure in China.
Which has been pretty rapid. We know that for a fact. So
yes,
we'll gloss over your lack of details. Vicky, you've got to have something better than that.
So I learned something absolutely stunning this week.
Apparently
other people knew this and have known this for ages, but I discovered it for the first time and my mind was blown. And that is that there is a bear in the Toblerone logo.
What?
What kind of bear?
I don't think it gets detailed enough to tell the species, but if you look at the Toblerone logo, you know what it is? It's that, like, triangular mountain, in the Alps or something.
I'm literally Googling this right now.
And in the shadows of the snow on that mountain, you can make out the outline of a bear.
Is it a tiny bear that's just on there, like, climbing, hibernating, doing
it's
whatever
It's a mountain-sized bear.
Oh, yeah. Hey, look, check this out. It's just there on the left.
It just looks like a tiny little dot.
Yeah.
But if you look closely, you'll see a bear. Next time you're in an airport, I guess, have a look at the Toblerones and see what they're...
So actually, I learned this is actually like a thing in advertising. So there are other ones where the white space makes up an image. So it was brought to my attention by a sports journalist friend recently that the F1 logo, I'd always thought that it was a black F and then a red 1. But actually, it's a black F. The red is just like a fancy swoosh. And the white space between the two is the 1. And if you look at the FedEx logo, the gap between
the arrow, like
the E and the X or something is an arrow.
Well, there's a lot to logos.
I'd never noticed before.
And we're all blind to them. It's just being sort of subliminally put into our minds. I've got a really depressing fact now, or something that I learned this week. Snooty, the world's oldest manatee, who was born in July 1948, passed away this week.
Aww.
Oh, that's very sad.
It is.
I think I'd probably be sadder if I knew what a manatee was.
Roland, they're like those big kind of
sea hippos.
Yeah, like sea lion, dolphin things.
So, like a massive seal.
Kind of, yeah. And they live like in Florida.
Yeah, there's a...
Oh, yeah, I think I know.
They've just got a big flat nose and you always see them in sort of videos online when they're held in captivity, like bumping against windows and sort of squishing their face.
Yeah, I know. I think I've definitely seen those videos and obviously identified heavily.
Well, just take a moment for Snooty.
Oh.
Moving on. The first story we're talking about this week is about Roomba, the vacuum cleaner, not a Hoover, because that's a brand name, I'm reliably informed, wants to collect your data from your living room, or it has been collecting your data from your living room, but it wants to do stuff with it. Vicky or Roland, do either of you own a Roomba or any other branded vacuum cleaner that can trundle around and clear up after you?
I don't, but I have always wanted one. I think they're super cute. I've seen that video of the cat in a shark costume sitting on top of one, and yeah, I've always wanted one, but they are still quite pricey.
Yeah, I investigated getting one, and you know how on the internet sometimes when you look at a product and you read all the reviews and you sort of start convincing yourself that £800, yeah, of course, that would be a reasonable thing to spend on a robotic vacuum cleaner that people say only works 90% of the time. So I came really close, and then I sort of told some people and they were like, are you completely mad? And then I realised, yeah, this is too much, but I would like one. Yeah, so, well, I don't anymore. I don't want one if it's going to be spying on me.
So
I've got my Echo for that.
Where this came about was Colin Angle, the chief executive of Roomba, and actually the chief executive of iRobot, which is the company that makes the robots. He said in an interview with Reuters that the firm hopes to collect all the data that its Roombas have been gathering about where their positions are and their location in your home from all the sensors that are embedded in it, and sell this to some of the biggest technology companies in the world. He named Apple, Amazon and Google as being the people he's targeting, and said that he hopes that the data and maps of your living room and other rooms in your home will be sold to them within 2 years. That's what they're aiming for.
So why would anyone want that data? Why would someone want a map of my living room?
So according to Roomba and its chief executive, this is so it can really, well, for them, they want to make money from this. Obviously, that's what they're trying to do with selling your data. But apparently, in their view, you can customize your smart home by using this data. So effectively, if a company knew where your windows were in your room, and then they looked at the sort of your smart light bulb, it could change its brightness and what it's doing automatically based on the time of day and the light where it's coming in. It might be able to shine light into a different corner and really just like alter what is around you, which is
kind of like a personalization of the Internet of Things,
effectively
bespoke to your home.
Yeah. Well, it's just like it's like any of this data stuff, isn't it? It's on its own, it's not that helpful. But if you incrementally, the more data you get from different aspects, it all adds up to be able to create some kind of dystopian, personalized kind of where. So, because like if you look at like health data, you know, if you're kind of able to get someone's heart, like kind of the data about their heart rate, about their sleep, about the way they walk, eventually you'll be able to maybe even to give them personalized products, but maybe even kind of make those products kind of correct for them, so that you can make decisions on their behalf that are better than decisions that they could make, right? This is the idea.
Yeah, I think so. It's about personalization. It's about adapting to a customer on like a really basic level. And one of the other examples that Roomba gave was if they knew the shape of your room, then your speakers could change acoustically to actually project sound in different ways, or change what's happening in terms of the sound area. But is anybody surprised that Roomba wants to sell this data?
I am. I mean, with these things, whenever we hear that an Internet of Things device is kind of could use data in a different way, I'm always initially really surprised, and then very quickly like, well, obviously, of course, they were going to do that. But I think it is surprising, because when you buy the product, you never imagine that data could leave the product. And I think, you know, it is something that as consumers we're having to come around to and realize that actually you don't necessarily own everything, all of the data that these devices collect, and you have to be very careful about what you're letting them do and what permissions you give them.
Yeah, I think this discussion is actually kind of quite complicated in some ways, isn't it? Because quite often when you're talking to people about privacy, it sort of comes down to like something really basic, like, oh well, I wouldn't want anyone watching me while, you know, in the shower. And that's actually, in a way, that's not really the problem, because I assume Roomba will say this data is anonymized. At least,
yes,
in the sense that it's not connected to other information about you. But the real problem comes is that you can see, like, who are they selling it to? Well, actually, they name a very few companies, really, really massive companies, that already own huge, kind of great swathes of our digital lives. And that's because this system only works if you've got a shared load of data from all other kind of sources. And that leads into, well, something that we kind of often talk about on this podcast is the kind of the problem of digital monopolies. And it is, I mean, you know, basically you'd have to kind of, if you wanted these effective little things that it could do to help your life in tiny ways, you'd have to buy into, say, like the entire Google ecosystem. You'd have like the Nest thermostat, you'd have the Google powered windows, does Google have like a speaker system? It probably does, right?
Well, they've got their Google Home.
Exactly. Google Home, exactly. And that creates that ends up having really kind of strange knock-on effects in terms of with all the kind of bad stuff of monopolies. So yeah,
it's unsettling, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I personally always find that the moment that a company says we're thinking about selling the data, what I'm hearing is our product sales aren't that great.
Well, and this is also the thing, because if you're spending so many hundreds of pounds on a Roomba vacuum cleaner, and they're not cheap, as we said, then I just kind of feel a bit like, how is this justified? You're then going to make money from me? You're making money from the thing that I've already paid you lots of money for?
Yeah, for me, I think this is like an example of how a lot of products and devices are going to change in the future. Like, traditionally, a business model has been a company produces something and sells it to a customer. That is it. You get the product, you can do whatever you like with it. But now we're obviously getting so many more connected products. The business model is also changing for these companies, and that's something that Roomba is clearly looking at its shift in what it's doing. Because, like, if somebody's got a Roomba for 5 years, Roomba's made that money off it once, but actually now they're looking to try and make some more money off selling the data and actually getting something else. So it's a bit of a shift in attitude. And like Roland, as you say, with wearables, connected, autonomous cars, everything around there, everything that is connected is going to have this potential. And I don't think that consumers are actually told that much about where their data goes at the moment, and the privacy potential pitfalls and implications of this being sold on and collected about you.
Yeah, and I think also it's that if people are confused, then that's fair enough. I think it's hard to see the harms that this causes. You think, oh well, listen, like, would I give up my data, which I don't do anything with anyway, and I can't do anything with, just to have like a slightly better life? And you can save me £100 a year, I don't know, or whatever, on my energy bill. Well, yeah, why not? And it's only much later on when you realise that there's only one energy provider in the world, and that's Amazon, and the prices start to go up, that you realise that actually all the way along you've been kind of helping create this monopoly. And that is really hard to see, and also just a made up example that might not even happen.
Exactly. Well, I think the key takeaway is check your privacy policies. Have a wild Friday night doing that.
Great. Yeah.
Vicky, you had a much better night one night this week when you went to Paris.
So I went to see a premiere of Valerian, or Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, which is the new sci-fi film from French director Luc Besson. He's got a very fantastic track record of filmmaking, and on the sci-fi side, he made The Fifth Element several decades ago now, and he made Lucy a couple of years ago with Scarlett Johansson. Valerian. It stars Dane DeHaan and Cara Delevingne, and it's also got a kind of much publicised appearance by Rihanna. It takes a pretty kind of standard sci-fi story, I'd say. Floating out in space. Intergalactic warfare. I'll try to keep it spoiler free. I mean, if I give you just like an idea of it. So basically, Dane DeHaan and Cara Delevingne are Valerian and Laureline. They're partners, both romantically and also in their kind of space saving the world efforts. Mm-hmm. It's set in a universe where there are many different planets and many different worlds, different alien species, and essentially there's a kind of loose plot where they have to save a planet from destruction.
Is it any good?
So
the nervous laugh of a no.
It's good fun. I can't say I didn't enjoy it, because I did. It's definitely a feast for the eyes. The visual effects are everything.
They've spent
film.
A lot of money on this, right, haven't they?
An awful lot of money.
This
so
is damning with the faintest of praise.
It's rumoured to be the most expensive European film ever made, and the most expensive independent film ever made. And you can see where that money's gone, because there's so many visual effects. It's absolutely crazy, because you've got all... It's not just one fantasy world, right? It's all these different ones with all different creatures. It is a joy for the eyes, and if you're into, great CGI and aliens and that kind of thing, then yeah, you probably enjoy that. There isn't much in the way of storyline or character development. It's much more just to sort of sit back and enjoy watching it rather than,
Not over. I got that as not overwhelmingly positive. Yeah,
I really like this sort of thing, but on the basis of that, I think I might go see Dunkirk instead.
Yeah, very, very different stories, I imagine.
Yeah, and there's a few other points around this as well. And sort of, is one of these how sci-fi presents technology and sort in terms of filmmaking and like what how
yeah,
it's
portrayed? So this is one thing I'm always interested in, obviously, as you know, someone who's interested in technology and in the tech world. One thing that science fiction is usually, you know, really interesting for is suggesting how technology might work in the future and what our future might look like. So most of the action in this film takes place on essentially the International Space Station, but it's in the 28th century, and the space station has had module after module added to it as different people from different countries join the sort of space race, I guess. And then eventually people from different planets, so different aliens, also kind of attach their ships to the space station. And it gets so big that the Earth decides that, you know, they have to release it from Earth's gravity because it's posing a threat. And so it becomes its whole own space ecosystem. And it's a melting pot of different cultures as a result. So it's quite an interesting idea. And I should say that the film is based on a comic series of the same name, Valerian. So that's pretty cool. There are a few recognisable technologies in there. There's one place where Valerian and Laureline visit a world that you can only see through a pair of kind of augmented reality or virtual reality goggles. And they're actually seeing into a different dimension. But I've
not
that, quite
that
funny.
Futuristic, I guess.
Well, we haven't figured out different dimensions yet, but yeah, it is quite amusing because the goggles that they have do look very much like the sort of thing that we have today. And you kind of think, you know, in 800 years into the future or something, will we not have managed to do this without some sort of dorky headset? There's a self-driving spaceship as well, but I found it quite interesting that our heroes are usually opting to drive manual. Presumably because it would be very boring to watch people pilot a driverless spaceship in a film.
Yeah, it doesn't film 90 minutes or however long however long you need to. And you had some other criticisms as well around the portrayal of women in this.
Yes. Surprise, surprise. No, I mean, well, this is another reason that I, you know, I do so much want to like sci-fi. It's very much something that I should be into, but I find that so often the portrayals of women just fall short, and I did feel that this was the case in Valerian. I mean, so Cara Delevingne plays Laureline, Valerian's kind of partner, and you know, she has a good role. They're pretty much equal in terms of, you know, they're both saving the world together. She's sometimes having to go rescue him as well as him rescuing her, so that's great to see. But you know, the first we see of her on screen is her bikini clad bottom. And yeah, there's a kind of a bit of a stereotypical love story. You know, Valerian has had all these women before, and Laureline thinks that he's scared of commitment. You know, it doesn't really paint either gender very well. And it's just a bit tired. And I think, you know, this is the year 2800. We've got all kinds of aliens. Could we not have, like, imagined a future where maybe there was a different gender balance or, you know, maybe some of the space commanders were women and not men, and they are all men, you know. Well, is that so difficult to imagine when you've got all these alien worlds?
Well, we were talking about this earlier, weren't we, in the week? Yeah, because I was about how those kind of great science fiction writers of the 1950s did actually predict so much. They got so much correct, but they completely missed the kind of gender revolution. They did not see, for example, that women would enter the workforce. So it's like virtual reality goggles, tick. The internet, totally. Women in the workforce, no. Like,
too much of a stretch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
too unbelievable.
But I think, you know, but also is that it's actually a kind of a weakness in sci-fi in general that it's better on sort of hard tech than it is on social trends. Mm. And I mean, maybe that's just because it tends to be written by blokes.
Maybe. I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm not expecting to see, you know, science fiction portrayals that are always like, oh, men and women are perfectly equal. But you just think they could take into account, yeah, social issues. So if you think of things like The Handmaid's Tale, which is obviously based on the book by Margaret Atwood and is a great series out at the moment, that shows women obviously in a much worse position. And it's kind of taking this, you know, this idea that the balance
so
could alter
dark.
In a different way.
So
it's very dark, but it's really good, right?
Oh man, it's so good.
Yeah.
Oh, and huge news for sci-fi nerds out there. They're making an adaptation of Ursula Le Guin's book, The Left Hand of Darkness. I actually punched the air when I read this, and then I just started to feel like so stressed out because oh my god, they're going to mess it up. But that's a book set like so many years in the future, but it's on a planet where there's no gender, where all the kind of individuals are, I guess, like hermaphrodites, and it's an incredibly fascinating exploration of gender in a future world. Basically, there's just like there is stuff out there that sets a standard and is way better than this.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, I feel like, you know, this kind of tired old thing is pretty tedious.
It's just a bit annoying, yeah. And I mean, it's not just gender as well. So another thing that I kind of rolled my eyes at is there's one alien species in Valerian which is idealized. They live in this absolute paradise and they're totally peaceful and amazing. And they are like really thin and really tall. They look like supermodels and they are pearlescent. They are whiter than white. And it's just a bit, really?
Yeah, that's not cool.
Yeah. Although really all I'm thinking about this or the whole time is about Valerian steel swords. Sorry. I mean, that's a Game of Thrones reference. I just was suddenly taken off to another kind of sexist realm.
But that's a whole different chapter and a whole different story, and we could do a whole podcast on that.
And
but
that's more fantasy than sci-fi.
Yes, exactly. Make an artificial distinction.
It is. Well, Valerian is out now, Vicky.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, you know, if you're one of those people who likes kind of amazing VFX space battle stuff, it's, you know, it's a fun ride.
Yeah, if you want to go see it and watch it and have views on this, you can feel free to tweet Vicky. I'm sure you'll
tweet me
up
at Vicky
debate.
Turk. Tell me I'm totally wrong. I'd love to hear from you.
Roland, if I had a new idea for a startup, I've got this crazy idea, I want to create a guitar for dogs. Traditionally, I would go and I would speak to some investors once I've created a product and try and convince them to give me their money. This doesn't have to be the case now, does it?
No. Something incredibly weird and fascinating and complicated is happening out in the world of Bitcoin and blockchain and startups, and that is called initial coin offerings. And yeah, it works exactly like this. Well, more or less. You've got an idea for a startup. Instead of going to a venture capitalist and asking them to give you money, you can create something called tokens. And you can ask people to buy those tokens in exchange for loads and loads and loads of money. Like, we're talking $150 million more. And this is going on all the time. And there's this gigantic bubble in the world of digital tokens. And yeah, I mean, I honestly don't know what this means, but it is totally fascinating. I'm completely obsessed by it.
So is this like a Kickstarter, or is it more sophisticated than that type of thing?
It's a little bit like a Kickstarter, yeah. So, I mean, so what a token is, it's like technically it's kind of like a cryptocurrency, but really what it is, it's like a voucher for a supermarket that hasn't been built yet. So because what the token does, it's a coin which you can only use for the startup that they're creating. So it might be so a good example is Kick, the messaging app. They're kind of getting up to do one of these initial coin offerings and say, I'm not totally sure what their token does, but it might give you, you know, like credits or stickers or data or whatever. But it's basically functionally useless, and people are buying this with actual money, or well, actual bitcoins or actual ether, which is another kind of cryptocurrency.
So it's like a made-up voucher for a made-up thing that doesn't exist yet, and people are spending a lot of money on them.
You've understood it perfectly. Beautifully expressed.
Why? Why? Why are people doing this?
Well,
I mean, I could see why you'd do one on behalf of the startup raising money. That sounds great. I would do one right now. But yeah, why would people buy them?
Well, so, because I think you've got to understand why, you've got to look past the actual kind of worth of these tokens, and to understand that there's a massive bubble going on right now, and people are trading these tokens and using them to make money. So I mean I'm sure you all know about the tulip bubble of the 18th century, when the price of tulips reached this kind of this vast amount. I mean, that's the kind of the archetypal bubble. But what that gets at is that the kind of inherent value of these things doesn't necessarily matter that much once they're being valued within the community at great amounts. And so this is why you might invest. Of course, this kind of raises a whole bunch of questions like, hey, where does all this money go in the end? And the answer is we're not totally sure.
Right. So it's not like a Kickstarter because people aren't actually doing it really necessarily to fund the project. They're doing it to then speculate with these tokens and hopefully make money on them.
Ah, no, sorry. So this is the kind of, it's a bit like, say if I think that the startups are often doing it to make their startup. I mean, it really varies. But the it's a bit like if I said, oh look, I've got this this Kickstarter. It's you know, I can try. I got it when it was $25 on the like the low, you know, the basic level. Now it's worth 45, but I'll trade it to you for 35. That's kind of that's like the sort of what's going on in this world. Does this make sense?
They're worth as much as people will pay for them, and people will pay quite a lot at the moment. So
exactly, and so this is kind of what's going on. This is why these prices are just going up through the roof. And I mean, there's always people love to talk about bubbles in tech. And most of that talk is actually really kind of ill-informed. But this is 100% a speculative bubble. And you can, I mean, you know, all kind of everyone involved in it says that. But it's also doing something which has kind of never been done before. And it is, yeah, it's totally fascinating.
So why would a startup choose to do this rather than go down that traditional investor VC route?
Oh, well, I mean, because, you know, why pitch to VCs who will scrutinize you and you know, can ask you loads of like difficult questions and just basically not get it, when you could crowdfund in this way and raise actually way more money. Yeah. I mean, you know, so like, of course, again, this relates back to the kind of like the worth of the projects. So like Kik, that's not been a really popular messaging app. You know, you might say this is their last hope, and then you might say, well, they're not really worth it, but we'll see. We'll see. I mean, maybe, you know, they know better. I mean, crowdfunding is a really amazing... That's how it's just Kickstarters work. Because people think that with a Kickstarter that you buy a product. You don't. Actually, what you're doing is lending the money to someone in order to make their product. Or at least that's how Kickstarter should work. I mean, you know, there's a lot of kind of funny business on Kickstarter as well.
So, I mean, fundamentally, I just can't help but have this feeling that it all... sounds a bit dodgy. Am I justified in having that feeling?
What, Bitcoin dodgy?
No, ICOs in particular. You know, like the whole thing feels a bit like, well, if it's that easy, there's something, you know, I mean, how does this fit into the rest of the financial system?
Yeah, I mean, I think basically it is dodgy, but it's also really interesting. And I guess the word is innovative. There's something totally new going on here, and often the sort of the strange dodgy things then turn into the kind of more generally useful things. I mean, let's not talk about the blockchain, because it is like the world's most confusing, boring topic, but in a way, like, what is all going on here, it might be the ultimate test for the blockchain, or the test for this kind of system that's called Ethereum, which all this is happening on. I'm sure a lot of people are going to lose a lot of money, or, you know, people may, you know, they might get their money stolen.
And it's not regulated at all.
No, so actually this is the kind of the latest news on this. Basically, in most, the wording on this stuff is quite careful to kind of get around regulations. And that's, like, to be honest, probably a big part of why you would go and raise money in this way. But the SEC, the body which regulates this in the US, has said that it does think that ICOs would come under its regulations. And that would change how these things were done in the US. Although, I mean, as we know with Bitcoin, I mean, the fact that it's completely transnational means that these kind of local regulations don't matter so much. But that would have an impact.
And to put this into some perspective that people can probably conceptualize a little bit more than just digital tokens floating around in the blockchain, how much money have people been raising off this sort of thing? And it's really quick as well, isn't it?
Oh, I mean, people are raising millions of dollars. I mean, millions of dollars in Bitcoin, or in more likely in Ether, in minutes, in half an hour. But I last time I checked, the whole ICO kind of fundraising was total about $3.8 billion. So it's getting pretty big, and even more just keep on coming online the whole time, bigger ones, you know, weirder ones. And I mean, and also it's that people are investing in really strange technologies, technologies that just couldn't get funded normally. And sometimes that's just because they're terrible, but it also might be because, you know, like VCs, they are terrible, they're awful judges of this sort of stuff. They're just making random guesses a lot of the time. So maybe, yeah, some projects that would never have been funded otherwise will actually get off the ground. And make really strange things, you know, even stranger than Bitcoin and the blockchain.
It's an incredibly complex area, and we have more than one article online on wire.co.uk describing ICOs, how they work in a little bit more detail, and some people that have been involved in them as well. And I think it's definitely worth going to look at, because this is it may be a bubble, it may disappear, but actually at the moment, in terms of startups getting funding and self-funding effectively, it is something that is new. It's something we haven't seen before.
Yeah, exactly. And I just did a really terrible job of explaining it, because because it's like you're sort of trying to keep it simple, but it's so complicated. Please tweet me and tell me how badly I did that. And also, and then also tell me about the latest ICOs. I'm interested, not in investing.
On the back of this week, Yancey Strichter, the CEO and co-founder, I think, or founder of Kickstarter, left the company to pursue other options. And I thought I would give you both a little quiz in our new format feature thing that we're doing regularly, to see how much you know about Kickstarter and some of the projects that have been on the website in the last 8 years or so since it was founded in 2009. So a nice easy one to start you off. What was the biggest funding round, effectively, or how much did how much in what they call donations?
Yeah,
donations were given to the biggest Kickstarter project, and what was it? So I'm looking for a figure and a product. It's
okay.
And this one actually holds the record. Well, it held the record once, and then it beat its own record later on.
I don't think I actually know this.
I know a few things that have held the record, but I don't know if I know the current one.
A drone one? There was a drone one. The potato salad one was very effective.
Was it Pebble?
Pebble.
Oh.
And I think, because I wasn't sure if it was the Oculus or if it was Pebble. So we're looking for their first one or their second one?
The second one, the bigger one.
Wait, so Pebble, RIP in peace.
Yes, as well.
Yeah. I'm going to go, it's not that much by, like, you know, kind of fundraising standards. I'm going to say 2.5 million.
Vicky, any advance on that?
10 million.
You're closer. It was 20 million for the Pebble time, which was in 2015, and I think the first Pebble one was around 5 million ish, and that was like 3 or 4 years earlier. Obviously, that money has not really done that much because the company doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, shame.
What was the first Kickstarter? What was the first thing that was successfully funded? This is quite an open-ended question. But it's quite basic.
Huh.
Like, it's not a big tech project. It's not something that's really highly sophisticated.
Someone's like homemade lemonade or something.
Yeah, or is it like I don't know, like some kind of chair or some.
Or a book. There were like loads of books and stuff at the beginning, weren't there?
Yeah.
You're getting closer, so I'm just gonna explain it because you're never gonna guess. It was a drawing. A person called LJ Rule created a Kickstarter for $20. He was aiming to raise. He raised $35, and it was for a drawing of a half dragon man with a pitchfork and some skulls who is flying towards a city to wreck it. That's what.
So it's basically using Kickstarter like Etsy.
Yes, effectively it was. But this was back in 2009. It was the first properly funded thing, and he did provide a drawing to the three people that gave him backing.
Do you, by the way, do you many Kickstarters, either of you, just out of curiosity?
I don't think I ever have.
I've never done one, no.
Okay.
No.
Have you? What have you backed?
Oh, a whole bunch of stuff. Oh man, I've got this incredible lamp that is about as thick as a copy of Wired magazine, but it's got these drawings on it so that it looks like it's a 3D shape. But sometimes I back these things and then they never arrive on time. And then about a year later, you'll get something in the post and from some strange location. You'll be like, oh yeah, that Kickstarter I backed.
Have you ever been really disappointed?
No, I'm always really pleased, actually. Yeah,
you must be very careful with the ones that you back. Because obviously a lot of them just never come to fruition, do they?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you're desperate to throw your money away, then
Which brings me nicely onto the next question.
Ah, okay.
Which one of these five okay, maybe six, I haven't properly counted, Kickstarter project isn't the real one. A sculpture of some crystal bacon. Combat kitchenware, a frying pan with a sword that's attached to it. An Internet of Things towel rail. The world's largest jock strap. And finally, a Doctor Who rap album. Which one isn't real?
I don't have a clue.
The kitchen knife thing.
Oh, I was going to go for that. Okay, I'll go for the... Based on my knowledge of Matt Burgess's psychology, like what would he make up? I'm going to go for the jockstrap.
No, that was real. And that was a Guinness World Record. Artist Michael Barrett raised $854 to manufacture the world's biggest jockstrap.
Yeah.
The one that wasn't real was the Internet of Things towel rail.
Oh, okay.
Everything else was real. And I think they were all backed as well. There's always someone. I'm not sure what the scores are. I think it's maybe one all. I don't know. Two more questions. Kickstarter launched in April.
This is competitive.
You may win. There's no prize. But Kickstarter launched in 2009, as we've said. How much has it actually received in pledges so far altogether?
Well, I don't know.
Well, if the record one is 20 million.
Yeah. This is US dollars.
Oh, God, that doesn't help me much.
Do you think it's reached a billion?
Yeah, I think it maybe has.
Oh, I might go just for, 900 million then. Or higher or lower.
Maybe half a billion, so 500 million.
Roland, you've got this. Hypothetical point. 3 billion in pledges this year.
What do you mean a real point? Thank you.
And finally, this is one that is probably going to be easy and is a bit redundant because we may have already said the answer. Zach Danger Brown asked for $10 to complete a Kickstarter.
Is that the potato salad one?
It was the
potato salad Kickstarter.
Yeah. So I think that's a draw to all, I'm going to say. And if you want to know about his potato salad, he raised $55,000. But he gave it all to charity, which is very nice of him and a good use. I don't know if he made a potato salad as well. But he raised a lot of money. And Kickstarter's obviously raised a lot for a lot of people over the years. I think that's all we've got time for this week. Yeah.
But we should mention, though, that we've got a really interesting interview with Yancey Strickler on our YouTube channel. Asking him kind of questions about, what happens when, A, something gets really big and all the people who've sort of invested don't get anything. And also about, all the things that don't work out and how exactly Kickstarter works.
Yeah, definitely. Should go check out that interview. All the stories we've talked about this week are on the Wired website as well. And we'll speak to you again soon. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.